by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
You're listening to The Information Advantage. This is WILL Urbana. It's a broadcasting service of the College of Communications here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. My name's Todd Gleason. I'm sitting in this afternoon for Celeste Quinn, who is away. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our topic for the afternoon, rural healthcare. We're joined in studio by Ira Moscovice, who is the director of the University of Minnesota Rural Health Research Center, and Paul McNamara, who is with the University of Illinois College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences and Extension. He is a rural healthcare extension specialist. Gentlemen, good afternoon. Thanks for being with us today.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Let's start with you, Ira, just a bit. Tell me what Rural Health Research Center might be, please.
It's one of the 8 federally funded rural health research centers sponsored by the Health Resources and Services Administration of the Department of Health and Human Services. And we work on policy analysis issues that are important to rural health care. Our specific focus is primarily on quality of care issues, but we define quality of care very broadly. So we look at the performance of rural hospitals, rural physicians, and how they relate to the meeting the community needs for rural populations.
And Paul, you're an economist that takes a look at health care and how rural health care impacts the local economies.
That's right. I run a program called the Illinois Rural Health Workshop, and we work with hospitals and local communities to explore the relationship of health care and their economic vitality.
And just so that everybody is aware, we are taping this on a Monday afternoon. The program airs on a Tuesday afternoon, so we will not be taking calls this afternoon. But we will explore as thoroughly as we can over the next 40 minutes or so the topic of rural health care. Ira, in your work, what have you found that the most troubling factors might be for rural health care and in a community, in any given community primarily?
I think if we were to generalize from my perspective, one of the main concerns are really the myths that are out there that rural health care is not as good as urban health care. And I call them myths because there's not empirical evidence to support those beliefs, but yet many people feel that a priori, all other things being considered, bigger is better. And what's important to understand is that's not necessarily the case. And so what we're trying to do is to establish some empirical evidence that shows where rural health providers and communities are really excelling and where there are areas for improvement. And we think it's really important to try to dispel myths that aren't true and to try to substantiate areas where rural health care needs to be improved.
Give me an example of a myth.
One of the myths would be, well, if I get really sick, I should bypass my local rural hospital and travel 50 miles to the big city because I can get better care there. We know statistically, looking at national information, that if I have a simple pneumonia, quite frankly, statistically, I'm better off going to my local rural hospital. If I have an AMI, a heart attack, we know statistically that you are better off going to a larger hospital. So the point is, it really depends on what kind of condition, what kind of resources your facility has, and who's involved locally as to whether or not you should be, how you should be using your local facilities.
And in general, where do rural healthcare systems excel?
They excel basically in the things you'd expect, primary care, services that are needed by communities. And so whether it's services provided by family physicians or, as I said, simple pneumonia, non-high-risk deliveries. These are things rural hospitals do really well. Where they don't excel or where you need secondary and tertiary care specialists. So if you have a very complicated situation, you are much better off going to a larger facility. But if you're talking about chronic illness is also another great example of how rural providers can relate to the local community. They know the population in their communities, and they do really well in terms of trying to provide chronic care for those who have chronic illnesses.
How do they do on differing populations? So those over 60, for example, those under 5, maybe, for example, as opposed to the larger middle area of the age groups?
I don't really have a lot of evidence on the under 5 population. Actually, that's an area that needs to be studied more, other than we know for simple deliveries, rural hospitals and rural physicians do very well. But it's that over age 65, the Medicare-eligible population, there has been a lot of work on. And as I said before, if we look at the three-legged stool of policy issues in the health sphere, i.e. cost, quality, and access, from a cost perspective, we know it's cheaper to take care of cases in rural areas. Access has always been an issue. We've dealt with many access issues around the country through federal programs and private sector programs. And so now access is a target issue, but we remain policy focus right now is on the quality of care being provided in rural areas. We want to make sure that the quality that's provided to the elderly in rural areas is good and equal, if not better, than quality of care provided to their counterparts in urban areas. And what we've seen, looking at data both in my home state and around the country, is that there are many areas where the quality of care for rural Medicare beneficiaries does excel and is very good, as I mentioned before, in terms of chronic illness care and in terms of dealing with simple, basic care that those over age 65, geriatric care and the like, that they require. Where we have a need for linkages to urban areas and for secondary and tertiary care specialists, or care for acute care illnesses related to heart and other kinds of conditions. So for basic primary care and chronic care, rural America statistics show health professionals are doing very well. It's that secondary and tertiary care linkages that need to be developed also with urban areas.
Paul, cost, quality, access, the three areas that Irith is laid out as areas that need discussion. Cost would be a place that you probably excel looking at. How important to in a local economy is the health care system? And does it matter much whether it's a hospital or clinics or outpatient sorts of primary care? If they've got a hospital, does it matter whether it's the hospital or something smaller than that, I guess is the question.
Well, a couple things about matter and does it matter. Thinking about the importance of it, one way I'm looking at it is from the community's perspective to see how the community expresses its value for those services. And what we can see from simple things like the community's willingness to contribute public funds to maintain a service like emergency medicine, the ambulance service, or public contributions to a local community-owned hospital, those kinds of funds, or private donations to hospital capital campaigns. We see that communities have placed an enormous amount of value in having access to local facilities. So a flip side of the cost is the value side of it. And I think what Professor Moskovitz is showing is for a lot of basic services, primary care service, chronic care service, in terms of measurable outcomes, there's real value. What I'm seeing is that communities are willing to actually spend money to make sure they have access to that and that they place a great deal of importance on it, and that questions for communities come up when they're doing things like a major employer in a community will make agreement with a health insurance plan that would steer their employees to a larger hospital maybe 30 miles away than where they have their manufacturing facility, that type of thing. So I'm looking at those kind of questions and helping communities sort through if they truly value this. Are there other financing decisions consistent with the value they say they place on it? On the cost side, I think there's a lot of evidence that costs, in fact, are lower for receiving the services in most rural settings, not if it's something where the volume doesn't justify the existence of the service in a rural community, but for the type of things that Professor Moskovitz is talking about, in fact, the cost tend to be lower in rural areas for those services. So for the public-funded programs like Medicare, it makes good sense to deliver those programs close to the population that's receiving them. And then when you look at the total cost, including the cost for families to move and to access care, to drive, if people can avoid making a lot of trips, that's going to lower the cost burden too for those patients and those families. So thinking about costs overall, it makes a lot of sense where we can to encourage people to utilize their local system. So I think getting our heads around these myths, and I hear them anecdotally in communities I work with, like this bigger is better myth, gathering evidence and trying to understand where there is evidence to support such a notion and where it's dispelled, that's a really important thing that we can learn from some of the research that Professor Moscovice has been doing.
Bigger is better for the service. Is it right then to say that bigger is better for the services that aren't used as often?
In general, that's really the case. And so the kinds of things I was talking about before, which are simple deliveries, pneumonia, chronic illness, those are things that rural hospitals see a lot of. And yes, you're right. It's going to be the rare circumstance where a small rural hospital would see one or two cases a year, and we're saying they're really set up to take care of that on an ongoing basis. And so usually it is for the volumes that are much larger.
What would you consider? How far out do you have to be for you to consider it a rural community, and how far out does it have to be in order to maintain higher end facilities? I suppose do you have an idea? I know to some extent it depends on whether they have interstates and whether they're in a mountainous region or whether it's flat and travel is straight. But what kind of problems geographically appear across the nation that affect health care?
Well, if we've learned one thing, it's that one rural area in Illinois is not like a rural area in Maine or out in Washington State. And so it's hard to generalize on that issue because there's a tremendous diversity of geographic locations. What's of interest is recently the federal government changed the definitions, the specific definitions of what we mean by rural and particularly what we mean by an underserved area. And as you might imagine, when you change definitions, there are winners and there are losers. And so it's a really important issue. There are several systems that have been developed to measure rural, ranging from the Census Bureau very constrained definition to looking at a continuum that says where you have the lowest density of population, i.e. frontier, which America, which is really out west in Montana and Wyoming, wide spaces like that, up to rural areas that are in counties that are adjacent to urban areas. And quite frankly, probably the space between Champaign-Urbana and Chicago, as you get closer and closer to Chicago, you're going to see more and more urbanization. And it's constantly changing. What we've seen in Minnesota and the Minneapolis Twin Cities area is that our seven-county metropolitan area is now a 13-county metropolitan area. So what once was rural is now considered urban. So this is changing, and so it's hard really to answer that. One definition for the Critical Access Hospital Program originally was that they wanted hospitals to be 35 miles from another hospital. But quite frankly, that's a very arbitrary number, not based on any norms that we can say are going to be a gold standard forever. So that was one definition. And often, historically, we would say a half hour from an urban, no more than a half hour away for primary care services, no more than an hour away for secondary and tertiary care services. But once again, these are just different judgments, subjective judgments that people are placed on that. But it's an important issue, and it really depends on the state and the locale you are as to what you really consider rural, because you could be 15 miles away in Montana from a secondary or tertiary care facility. But if there's a mountain pass, as you suggested, between the two, you know, that could be an hour drive, whereas it could be just a 15-minute drive on the interstate. So it really depends on a lot of factors.
Are rural care hospitals more likely to be not-for-profits than they are for-profits? And how does that differ in a rural setting?
That's a really important point. There are less than 10% of all the 2,300 or 2,400 rural hospitals in the country that are for-profit. So the vast majority are not for-profit, either private not-for-profit or county or / city-run facilities. And so that whole not-for-profit emphasis is out there. You're not going to go out and solve the cost problem in America, out in rural America. What we really want to deal with out there is the access and the quality issue. So that not-for-profit aspect of rural hospitals is really important because it really links very closely with a concept we'd call community embeddedness, where the hospital, the physicians are really closely linked with those who are living in the community. So when you're taking care of an elderly person or a younger person, you're really likely to know that person from church, from going shopping, from your kids playing soccer with their kids and the like. And that's an important aspect, a really positive aspect in terms of rural healthcare.
What kind of cost factors is that are, put in on a rural county or community and the way they go about marshaling assets for that not-for-profit organization?
Well, I think one thing that you need to keep in mind is that the payment streams that the rural providers are facing are somewhat different than in the large metro areas too. And another thing that's a little different is the role of managed care. I think it's quite different in the communities where we have the critical access hospitals. You're much less likely to see managed care plans being present there than you are in, say, a Chicago metro area. And so some of the economics, some of the bargaining that goes on within the system is very different. And some of the pressures both on the hospital and on the physician's practices to control costs are very different than they would be in a managed care system, in a large integrated healthcare system in an urban area. So I think the way the healthcare systems function and the kind of cost pressures they're facing are different types of cost pressures.
Explain that just a bit for me. So is the difference between, and we'll make it fairly simple, a Blue Cross Blue Shield kind of single family coverage care and an HMO, or are we talking about something far, far greater than that?
What I'm thinking of is, say, within Medicare, which for a lot of the small rural hospitals is very important payer and often is a large proportion of their patients are paid for mm-hmm. by Medicare. In urban areas, you're going to see much more likely that patients are going to be covered by a Medicare HMO. In downstate Illinois, those HMOs aren't even present in a lot of rural communities. So that's a very different type of situation for the hospital to face. And plus, the hospitals, the smallest hospitals, we have about 40 critical access hospitals that receive reimbursement on a cost basis from the Medicare system. So they're reimbursed very differently, and so costs mean something different to those hospitals than they do to hospitals in a larger community that's actively negotiating with health insurance plans and being paid prospectively ahead of time based on a diagnosis by Medicare.
You answered my next question in part, that they're paid ahead of time. So that's one of the differences. But what are the other sort of economic differences there? I mean, what's the economic difference between having an insurance plan that is covering on top, I suppose, of part of that program as opposed to just relying on the government for payments?
Here's some differences that I see in talking with hospital administrators. They cut both ways. Some of the smallest rural hospitals have difficulty even negotiating and getting participation in health and insurance plans, like having their providers be included in networks of providers that health insurance plans organize. So that's one thing, and it's about the economics of being small in that situation. Another part that's a positive for the smallest hospitals, the critical access hospitals, is that in dealing with the Medicare program, they get to be paid on a basis of their cost structure. So they're being paid on what it costs them to provide a service. And that's a different basis fundamentally than the basis that most hospitals deal with the Medicare system on. And so the pressures work different ways. But the small rural hospitals, and here I think it's important that our talking about rural health so far is focused mostly on hospitals, and there's other dimensions of healthcare systems that we may want to talk about. But the smallest rural hospitals, they're dealing with the economies of being smaller. They have special participation in the Medicare program because of things like the Critical Access Hospital program. And the economies of being small put them in unique positions negotiating with larger metro areas, whether it's access to specialists sometimes or participating in health insurance plan networks and being able to get reimbursement at specific levels that they want to be reimbursed at, those kinds of things. That's where the smallness cuts.
Do you look at the policy side of rural health care and how it works out of Washington, D.C.?
That's prime focus of our research.
Tell me about that and the ways, the discoveries that you've made along the way in terms of the important parts of policy as it comes out of the Senate and the House and across the president's desk.
A lot of ways you can answer that question. I think the most important thing that's happened at the federal level is they created a federal office of rural health policy, and that's in Department of Health and Human Services. And the reason they did that was that much of the policy that was being developed in D.C. really had an urban orientation, and it was an afterthought to say, well, how would this play out in rural areas? A good example of that is that prospective payment system that Paul talked about, originally set up as a hospital reimbursement system, but basically depend on having larger volumes so that the amount of payment really related having a certain scale, and you could absorb having some cases that took longer than others to take care of. And what happened in rural environments is that kind of a system that's based on average payments really didn't allow for the variation in care that happens a lot in a rural environment. And so as a result, we had to think through over more than a decade, how can we adjust or adapt the prospective payment system to try to work better in rural environments. What we've seen with the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, their goal is to try to coordinate policy efforts across all federal agencies in the health arena. And so whether it's dealing with the aftermath of Katrina right now, or whether it's dealing with how can we maintain home health services out in rural areas, or dealing with the issue of hospice care, or providing, making sure we have enough primary care students who are graduating in those primary care specialties from medical schools. This agency is trying to coordinate that. And so our research center is one, as I said, of eight funded by that agency, and they fund other projects also. But it's key that we have a focal point at the national level. At the state level, it's also really important, I believe, to have those kinds of focal points. And whether it's the State Office of Rural Health in a particular state, the State Hospital Association, the trade associations, or whether there are caucuses in the state legislature, it's really important to have somebody who's really trying to understand how policy is being made and how it can be best applied in rural America, rather than rural communities being an afterthought.
Is there for Minnesota, out of the University of Minnesota Rural Health Research Center, a policy statement of sorts that you take to the state? We call it the General Assembly here, but the state government, and say these are the things that need to be addressed on the policy side, or that we think you should at least look at?
I wouldn't say there's a policy statement. We don't really make policy statements. What we do is try to describe the policy environment, to analyze the policy environment, and work with the legislative and executive branch of government at the state level to try to make sure that the programs they're implementing are doing the things they want them to be doing out in rural America. And so rather than being an advocate for a certain type of policy, what we're doing is trying to help policymakers develop their agenda and also then try to make sure that we understand what's the impact of their agenda.
Hmm. Can you give an example?
At the state level?
Mm-hmm.
I would say we've been a couple of areas. We've been working at the state level with the critical access hospital program at the state level, trying to make sure that those hospitals, A, remain viable, and B, are really meeting the community's needs. What Paul mentioned before is that these smaller hospitals now are being recognized as not having the appropriate scale to provide services under a prospective payment system, and so we're going to reimburse them for costs. It's really important to understand that's not an excuse for being an inefficient provider. So we want to make sure the kinds of outputs from those facilities are really what's needed out there in the community. Second area is working with the health profession schools in our states, the medical school, the nursing schools, the pharmacy schools, and the like, to make sure that we get the right kinds of health professionals, health practitioners who are going to be graduating from these schools and willing to go out to rural areas, and trying to work directly with those institutions to make sure that the rural portions of the state get an adequate supply and distribution of providers.
Does that mean you recruit from rural areas, nurses and doctors to be, or does that mean that you tie scholarships to work in rural areas?
It certainly could be both. It could be a whole host of strategies. But certainly one of the things we've seen is if you go out and recruit students who have a rural background, they're much more likely to go back out to rural areas, and particularly if you give them a role model, a primary care role model in their training, so that they understand that you don't have to become a neurosurgeon to be deemed successful out of medical school, and that you don't have to work in a tertiary care center to really have a fulfilling profession as a nurse or a pharmacist and the like. And so it's really important that those role models get established and that we do create incentives. And it has to start really before they get into school. It has to start to make sure that we have the right kinds of science curriculum in high schools out in rural environments. It has to do with really having health fairs and the like, and bringing youngsters from rural communities into the health sciences, so they see that there are real potential jobs here that they can available to them in the future. And so it starts young, and it works its way through the system, so that the system knows that there, particularly state universities like Minnesota and Illinois, that they have a responsibility to make sure they're turning out an adequate supply of health professionals for their whole state, not just for the urban parts.
Are there successful programs that do just that? Is there one in Minnesota that's been capable of recruiting from rural areas and then having longevity in those rural areas after graduation?
Yeah, there are a couple of great examples around the country. In Minnesota, we have something called the Rural Physician Associates Program, which basically does exactly what you just said, which is recruit students preferentially from rural areas. It trains them and does their internships, clerkships out in rural communities. They're out there for almost a year. And what we've seen from that program is, guess what? Almost two-thirds of those students go back out to rural communities in Minnesota and practice primary care. So it's a great example in our state of a program that does just that.
Here in Illinois, the College of Medicine, University of Illinois College of Medicine at Rockford, has the rural medicine program, the RMED program, modeled along similar lines to the program in Minnesota that Ira mentioned. And it's now had enough track record that we're seeing the graduates having done their residencies, and it's having a similar success rate in getting students to go back and do rural medicine as they're trained to do. And there's particular parts of the training they receive that are meant to prepare them for working in a rural community, including some of their time spent doing internships and experiences in rural communities.
What do you find to be the biggest impediment to have urban students going into the rural areas? Do they simply not want to live in the rural areas, or is it a lack of money and payment once they get there and they don't understand the culture? I don't know whether you've got experience in this area. It's just kind of a wondering out loud question.
It can be all of the above, but certainly one factor is if you have a health professional who was raised in New York City or Boston, and then to ask them to go out to a rural area with their family, particularly if they have a spouse and they have children who have not experienced the rural culture, it's a totally different lifestyle out there. You are the center of the healthcare system out there. In many ways, you're on call 24/7. In other words, you see somebody in a supermarket, and guess what? They'll ask you a question about healthcare. And if you want that for your family and you want small town life and embrace it, it can be terrific. But more often than not, particularly in our current environment where the spouse may need a professional job also, sometimes those jobs aren't available. And it's just very difficult to recruit those folks out to urban areas. And so from a cost-effective standpoint, it's much better to try to recruit students from rural areas who have that experience and want to go back out.
Another dimension is in other areas other than physicians. I also mentioned things like pharmacists and other areas where there are those needs. We've seen some rural hospitals working with community colleges and other educational institutions to set up programs where they're essentially trying to grow their own. And there's some interesting models of that here in Illinois where some hospitals in northern Illinois band together in create the financing with the community college to train radiological techs. And so this is an area where the hospitals were seeing a lot of turnover and difficulty in recruiting, and the hospitals came together and addressed this workforce need. So I think this idea of trying to grow your own is something that the providers are working on too in some cases where maybe the turnaround time to produce a graduate isn't as long as a physician.
I want to go down, you mentioned pharmacists, I want to go down just a little different road very quickly. Has Walmart made a difference in rural health care?
I have a take on this. Ira may have some. A few years ago, we did a study in Western Illinois looking at pharmacy and issues about access to care and uncompensated care. And I think there is a concern about the changing nature of pharmacy benefit programs, mail order pharmacy, not Walmart per se, but new players in pharmacy, fundamentally changing the way people interact and get their drugs. And for some people, if the local pharmacist closes and you don't have a person in that community that an elderly resident can actually talk to understand their prescriptions, that community is losing a real asset if that person is forced out of business, if that local pharmacy is forced out of business. So we are seeing a sea change in pharmacy and the way people get their drugs, and it plays out in small communities I think somewhat differently than it does in larger communities.
Yeah, what I would add also is, from my perspective, the local rural pharmacist is a threatened profession right now. We're training people in pharmacy schools where the PharmD degree is the terminal degree. And these are people who are getting much more experience, as in many other health professions. They're more likely to stay in urban areas. And what we've seen from the recent Medicare Modernization Act, which is about to be unleashed in America and provide drug benefits for the elderly, the other side of that is that's going to make it very difficult for rural pharmacists to exist, a small town rural pharmacist to exist, because as you might imagine, what the government's is likely to do is to develop contracts and relationships with the Walmarts and the larger firms around the country, the Walgreens, rather than focusing on that small town pharmacist. So between that and mail order pharmacy, it makes it very difficult. And that also creates a huge problem for the local rural hospital who needs a pharmacist on staff. And what we've seen in recent studies is that more than half of the rural hospitals in the country don't have pharmacists full time. And about 10% had them there less than 5 hours a week. And so this is creating a large problem when you see older local pharmacists who aren't able to sell their practices because no one wants to come in with that responsibility and try to compete against the larger firms.
I guess my thought was maybe that Walmart would be filling a niche as those local pharmacists grow older in age. I don't know whether they're like farmers, which are what I generally deal with, but which are much older and retiring. And that Walmart, since it is in rural communities, many rural communities, that it would be filling a gap and a need in those areas by providing pharmaceuticals. And if the policy that's coming on board, it may in fact fill more need in that case?
There's two sides to the picture, and the Walmart discussion always raises a heated debate.
Always does. You bet.
On the one hand, clearly costs are lower, and the parking lots of Walmart are full, so they must be doing something right for people to be shopping there, and they're providing a service, as you're saying. The other side of it, though, is who's going to go out to the nursing home and look at medication issues there? Who's going to go to the local hospital and take care of medication issues there? Who's going to deal with if Walmart's 25 miles from an elderly person? Who's going to make sure that person gets services? If that person is a caregiver who can order through mail order or go out to Walmart, great. But if they're not, it makes life difficult. So there's two sides to that. There really are some benefits, but there are some constraints imposed also.
One of the interesting things about pharmacy is the nature of pharmacy has changed so much over time. And pharmacists do so much more than simply dispense drugs. They have a lot of knowledge that in specific cases they can bring to bear. And our reimbursement system really does not set up easy ways to compensate them and pay for that. It tends to be centered around paying for the delivery of a drug. And so we have a kind of an anomalous situation there where more and more of the value is embodied in their knowledge. But where our compensation system, our financing system, doesn't quite match up with that.
About 9 minutes left in our discussion this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with Ira Moscovice, who's a PhD and director of the University of Minnesota Rural Health and Research Center, and Paul McNamara, who works for University of Illinois Extension as a rural health care specialist. I want to go in just a little bit of a bit different direction, and I know, Paul, that you've had some experience in this area with the ability of rural and urban areas to work together, telemedicine, for example. How has that, and I'll call it to some extent an experiment, worked across the rural parts of America? And has it gone beyond that area at this time?
I think we have some really good examples of not just telemedicine, but other ways that smaller rural facilities are connected with larger facilities in urban areas. And there's a lot of evidence about this. I think Professor Moscovice could talk more about this, but there was recently a study that came out in the journal Health Affairs that looked at access and quality in rural areas. And one of the things the rural physicians mentioned in the survey reported in that study was that they have an easier time accessing specialists than do similar primary care physicians that are working in urban areas. So that even if they have to make a referral from a small town hospital to a larger hospital, say in Peoria here in Illinois, that on average is easier for them to do than the physicians that are also doing primary care in the metro area. That would be a generalization of that finding. So in some ways, we're seeing those kind of patterns, not only through technology, but through referral networks and other things working pretty well. In technology, I think we face a number of challenges, some on the reimbursement side. In a lot of areas, we don't have good ways of we have more technology, and we don't know how to use it yet in some areas. We're still grappling with how best to use it, where best to apply it, and also how to pay for it, how hospitals can practically use it. For instance, issues that cross state lines create problems for some payment systems and getting approval. Also, some of the technologies aren't just about patient care, but they're technologies in the area of information. And we're seeing those being used, even simple technologies like setting up benchmarking systems across groups of peer hospitals in rural areas. These kinds of things can go a long ways for helping hospitals improve their quality, focus on things that actually produce better outcomes. So I think we're seeing some heartening examples in the area of technology and application to help address some of these issues.
Your views on technology and quality and access of care in rural healthcare settings?
I think technology is perhaps one of the best solutions, but also one of the largest challenges right now for rural healthcare. And as we move into the digital age, what we see are large healthcare, urban-based healthcare systems like Kaiser Health Plan investing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in electronic medical records and the like. And what we need is to develop the basic infrastructure for health information technology in rural America. We need to make sure that rural communities have access to the internet. I know that may seem hard, but right now there are a lot of rural communities out there where health professionals and residents of the community don't have access to the internet for a variety of reasons. We need to make sure that that's available. We need to make sure when we go across geographic areas that there aren't surcharges imposed on telecommunications just because you're going across state boundaries or county boundaries for that matter. We need to make sure that in the rural health arena that the Universal Service Fund, which is supporting the use of health information technology, supports that use by health institutions as much as it's supporting the use by schools, by libraries, and other institutions in rural communities. And so what we really need is the federal government to develop a program that will create incentives for rural communities to really embrace health information technology and to really move into this digital age.
Would it be a grant program or some more legal system?
Well, it's not legislated. It's not going to be a legal system. I think what we're really talking about is having a demonstration program. There could be matching funds required. We could talk about a lot of different ways of doing this, but we really need to make sure that rural hospitals don't have just two computers. We really need to, in the facility, one in the administrator's office and one in the business office. We need to get well beyond that. When you look at things, in a small rural community, you can link health professionals and social service professionals and the community much more easily. You should be able to do that much more easily than in an urban community. But we need that basic infrastructure. And there are states like Iowa and Minnesota that have started to develop that infrastructure. And you see a much wider use of health information technologies in those states than in other states where that infrastructure hasn't been developed.
Can you explain what that infrastructure – I mean, I can understand the data, I suppose. What kind of infrastructure are we talking about? Are we simply talking about the ability to – access the net and large databases, or is there something more involved?
It's really linking people. It's linking the hospital with doctors through that electronic medical record, which is where we're moving. And whether we like it or not, within a decade, we're going to see a much broader use of the electronic medical record. And information means so much in the healthcare industry. It's not just providers, but it's also having the local community linked to those providers. And so we basically need to set up a system that links those who are using the system from the provider perspective and also from the consumer perspective. And that's coming. And what I'm saying is I hope we don't go the route of, well, let's develop it in urban America and see how it plays out in rural. I think we have some exciting opportunities for rural to take the leadership on this. And that's the key. I think urban America can learn a lot from rural America rather than always looking to the larger place for lessons to be learned in rural.
Is that because it's smaller and the database amounts would be easier to handle and that the players would know each other and be more willing to talk with each other about this? Or
all the above. The main challenge is how do you get vendors go out to smaller places with less volume, and how do you basically
provide that? You mean software package type vendors?
Absolutely. And how do you provide that in an economic way in a smaller scale environment? The scale of the environment lends itself so much more to people sharing information. You still have to build up firewalls and the like, but you can share information between one group practice with three doctors and one hospital in town. That's a much easier challenge than looking at the Twin Cities area where you have you know, 12 hospitals and, you know, hundreds of primary care doctors. And so I'm saying the opportunities there, what we need are people who are going both at the national and state level, say this is a priority. And we need to make sure that smaller size communities have access to this technology as well as larger size communities.
Paul, are you familiar with the way that Carl happens to work with the Monticello Hospital and the telemedicine that happens there?
And the emergency room,
yeah.
And having that ability to, in real time, consult with physicians where you have a patient in Monticello who can be seen, and you can have a physician at Carl here in Urbana look at the situation with the patient and get some consult there.
Yeah.
And so that's one example of it working.
Physically, they're about 30 miles apart.
Right. And that's one example of it working. There's a lot of other examples and demonstration projects of it working. And there's other simpler technologies that are really making a difference too, like the information and just the benchmarking example. But I think what Ira's talking about is even it's something more challenging in saying, we as a system and seeing in the country, we're going this way. How can rural be ahead of the curve? How can we use our smallness as an asset to think about how to do this and come up with some rural models that really work? And that, to me, is a challenge. And what I like about what Professor Moscovice is bringing up is he's pointing out some of the assets in rural communities. And in rural health, we do have a lot of assets, and some of the strength is the embeddedness of these healthcare, the hospitals, the practices, the ability of to work closely, those kinds of things are assets that we can build on.
We've come to the end of our time. Do you have any final words, Professor?
Not just that I am optimistic that we're coming to a point in the development of rural healthcare systems where people are starting to recognize that there is a lot of good going on out there, and that particularly these systems are meeting community needs, and that's the most important part, that they stay focused on their local communities and provide the kinds of services that are really needed by the residents, whether they're elderly or young.
To the both of you, thank you very much. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul McNamara is with the University of Illinois College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences and University of Illinois Extension, where he's a rural healthcare specialist and an ag economist. And Ira Moscovice is a PhD and the director of the University of Minnesota Rural Health Research Center. I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to the Afternoon Magazine. This is WILL Urbana, AM 580.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Time now for a check of the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. We'll start with the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, where futures were lower. Bean futures were off about a dime in the nearby November contract. That is, harvest pressure begins to ramp up across much of the Midwest. In fact, harvest proceeding very quickly with the beans, faster than most in the trade expected. We'll take a complete look at the numbers from the yesterday's crop progress reports during this afternoon's closing market report when we talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. From the wheat pit this afternoon, December futures finished like this. The high price at $3.30¾, the low at $3.25¾, and the December wheat settled at $3.27. They were down 2¼ today. March contract at $3.44½ high, low at $3.39¾. Settlement price at $3.41½, down 2½. And the May futures, $3.50½ high, low at $3.47. Settlement price at $3.48¼, down 1¾. And July futures, $3.57, the high, the low at $3.53. Settlement price at $3.54¾, down $0.01¼. September futures for the wheat pit, $3.62, the high, the low at $3.59. Settlement price there, $3.61. And the September wheat for next year, down $0.01.
From the Corn Pit, December futures, 204.5 the high, the low at 203. Settlement price at $2.03¼. They were off a penny and a quarter today. The March contract down 1¼ as well. Settlement price at $2.16 a bushel, with a high at 15, or rather at 17, the low at 15¾. May contract in the Corn Pit, 224.5 the high, the low at 223¾, rather 223¼. Settlement price at 223.5, down a penny and one quarter for the day. And July futures in the Corn Pit, 230¾ the high, the low 229.5. Settlement price at $2.30 even. They were off 0.75¢. Next year's December contract down 0.5¢, 245.5. The settlement price for the December corn next year, Red Dees had a high of 46 and a low at 45. Once again, settling right in the middle at $2.45¢. December oat futures, 159, the high, the low at 154.5. Settlement price at 155¼. They were down 4¼. And the March contract at 162.5, down 3¼. November bean futures, $5.65¢ the high, the low at 556.5. Settlement price at 557.5. They were down a dime today. January futures at 574, the high, low at 565. Settlement price at 566¾, down 9½¢. And the March contract at 581.5 high, low at 573. Settlement price at $5.74¼. They were off a dime for the day. May futures in the bean pit, 587.5 the high, the low at 579.5. Settlement price at $5.80. They were down 9¼. And July futures were off 8½¢ at 585, with a high of 90.5, a low at 84 even. August contract next year, 587 the high, the low at 582. Settled on that low. They were off 8½¢ for the day. October bean meal, 169.50, the high, the low at 167.40. Settlement price at 168.40, off $1.30 for the day. December bean meal, 170.80, down 160. October bean oil, 22.63, the high, the low at 22.03. Settlement price at 22.09. They were off 58. And December futures were down 66 at 22.28. The high there, 22.84. Low at 22.24. I'll return at just about 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time with the closing market report this afternoon. We'll talk with Don Day just after the bottom of the hour, 2:32, about the agricultural weather. And Wayne Nelson with L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana, will join us to take a look at the futures market. Now here's Jason Croft with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Well, it was a mixed day today. Feeder cattle and live cattle were up, and lean hogs and pork bellies were down. Let's start with September feeder cattle. The high today, 116.10, low 115.70. Settled at 116 even, that up 20. October feeder cattle, the high today, 114.60, the low 113.60. Settled at 114.55, that up 60. November feeder cattle, the high 113.87½, low 113.05, settled at 113.75, up 37.5. Cattle, live cattle for October, the high today 87.50, low 86.57½, settled at 87.42½, that up 20. December, high today 89.10, low 88.25, 89.07½, the settlement, that up 20. Moving on to lean hogs. 65.55 the high, 64.80 the low, 65.32½ the settled, that down 82.5. December lean hogs, high today 62.75, low 62 even, settled at 62.27½, down 77.5. For February, the high today 64.65, the low 63.80, 64.40 was the settlement, that down 55. For April, the high today 64.05, low 63.50, 63.87½ the settlement, down 47.5. And February pork bellies, 91.40, that was the high, 89.10 the low, settled at 89.30, that down 105. Checking the Wall Street market at the moment, the Dow is up 9 points at 10,452. The NASDAQ is down about 5 points to 2116. The S&P 500 is down a fraction of a point at 1215.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners.